So the reading is from Matthew chapter 13, verses 31 to 35, which can be found on page 980 of the Bibles on your table. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all your seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and perch in its branches. He told them still another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into a large amount of flour until it worked all through the dough. Jesus spoke all these things to the crowd in parables. He did not say anything to them without using a parable. So was fulfilled what was spoken through the prophet. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things hidden since the creation of the world.
Is that good? Can anyone hear that? Sorry, my voice is a bit croaky this morning. Racing beds around Chew Valley. Sounds weird. You can ask about it later if you want. Yesterday, there was a lot of shouting going on. So as a result, probably wasn't the best preparation for this morning, but... why don't I pray first before we start? Father, please give us ears to hear and listen and think. And help us to see your vision of the kingdom as it really is. Amen. Now, I wonder, I'm sure most of us here probably saw the tennis on Sunday and Andy Murray's tears. And if you were anything like me, you would have been quite affected by it. It was sort of sporting drama, really, at its best and most powerful. I found it incredibly moving to see him let the world in to his emotions and to let us see that he felt vulnerable and weak. And he made this speech about that, you know, it was really generous and gracious and heartwarming. You could sense in how he did it that he felt very vulnerable. And I guess the question for him and his family and his coaching staff would have been, how do we pick him up after that defeat? Another defeat in the final at Grand Slam. And I imagine there was a moment for him on Sunday, sometime in the evening when he was on his own, and in a moment of silence must have thought, you know, is this worth it? Is it ever... Am I ever going to win the Grand Slam? And I think it's fair to assume that if we're Christians here today, there'll be questions similar to that running through our minds about our Christian life. Why is it such a hard slog in God's kingdom? Is it worth keeping going? Because, I mean, it's really easy to get down as a Christian, isn't it? I mean, that's my experience. I find it that way. Life as a Christian can be really hard. And particularly when the Christian life seems tough or dull or boring, like it's not going anywhere particularly quickly. It's not exactly a blinding success story. I mean, after all, when was the last time one of your friends or colleagues became a Christian? Or if the gospel really is such good news, why aren't there people flooding in through the doors? We went leafleting in this area at Easter, and we were met by a deafening lack of interest in the gospel, and probably worse than that, just a bit of hostility. When did you last read an article in the press which actually said being a Christian was something which was worthwhile? Why is it we're more passionate about the latest film or bit of technology than probably we are, if we're honest, about elements of Christianity? Is it because deep down we think possibly, in some respects, God's kingdom is just not as good? Because at the end of the day, it's quite hard to sell a product which you don't really think is any good. God's kingdom, it just doesn't feel as strong or as successful as we think it should be. Because after all, you know, if Christianity is true, if God really is there, if he is sovereign over everything, why is it that it's tough? Why are things not better? Which begs the question, where's God's church going? Where's it going? Is it worth me keeping going? Is it worth me even joining? Are we backing the wrong horse? And the questions we may have, they're certainly questions which the disciples had at the time Jesus told them this parable, or these two short parables. See, the disciples, they were getting a hard time from the Pharisees along with Jesus. There'd been a fair amount of opposition. The crowd who'd been following Jesus when he'd been teaching, they hadn't exactly been wowed by what was going on. They hadn't been responding amazingly positively to this promised Messiah. And Jesus, he'd warned the disciples. He said, look, if you're going to follow me, times will be tough, it will be hard. And I guess for the disciples, the reality was kind of beginning to actually hit home. They were beginning to realize this was the case. Because God's kingdom, it was meant to come in power. And the disciples must have been wondering, where's the power? And probably, maybe they were thinking, this all has to feel of something which might derail before it actually gets anywhere. So Jesus tells both these parables. And he does it. The parables are told to correct wrong thinking about the kingdom, about his church. When I say kingdom, I mean his church. And what Jesus wanted is he wanted the disciples to see, he wants us to see, God's church as it really is and will be. And here's the point. God's kingdom may seem small now, but it will grow enormous and get everywhere. It may seem small now, but it will grow enormous and get everywhere. So this is what the parable says. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all your seeds, yet when it grows, it is the largest of garden plants and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and perch in its branches. The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed into a large amount of flour until it worked all through the dough. I'm sure we can see what's going on here. The mustard seed starts small but grows into a large tree. The yeast may be small, but when it mixed with the dough, it grows and gets everywhere. Small things get big. But the point Jesus is trying to emphasize here, it's not so much the final size of things. So the mustard tree wouldn't have been the biggest tree which the listeners would have known about. It was just a tree which grew in a garden. Final size is not what Jesus is trying to emphasize here. It's scale. Scale, which is important. So mustard and yeast, they're tiny, like little flecks of dust. But they produce or become something which is vastly out of all proportion to their original size. So Jesus is saying, if you're going to make your decision about joining my kingdom, or about staying in my kingdom, if you're going to make your decision about, is it worth following me, think about what the kingdom is going to become, not just what it is at the moment. In other words, get your thinking about my kingdom straight. Now, in the spring of 1976, there was an engineer called Ron Wayne, and he was persuaded to invest $2,000 in a startup computer company operating from a suburban garage in California. And he did, he invested $2,000, but within weeks of doing it, he sort of got cold feet. He wasn't convinced by the vision of the owner, and he didn't want to risk losing his money. So he sold his shareholdings, got his money back. Now, That was Apple Computers. And had he retained his investment of $2,000, his shareholding today would be worth $2.6 billion. Now, when Steve Jobs, Apple's sort of visionary leader, called Ron Wayne to look ahead and see where the company was going, see what the small company could become, all Ron Wayne could see was a little single garage in suburban California filled with spare parts. And he must have thought to himself, this doesn't look like success. It doesn't look like a winning horse. Now, Apple was recently valued at $600 billion. That makes it the most valuable company in the world. And I did a little bit of digging about the stats, and apparently it's worth more than Belgium, or Sweden, or Saudi Arabia, or Taiwan. But it did start in a suburban garage only 40 years or so ago, filled with spare parts and a couple of guys sticking them onto transistor boards. It was a tiny seed which became a huge tree. But that kind of scale is nothing compared to the scale which Jesus is talking about, the growth of his church. It is nothing. So Jesus, he promises his kingdom, it is going to grow huge. But has the promise come true 2,000 years ago? And if his promise is that it would grow huge, and it has, why doesn't it feel that way? Well, think about the fact that when Jesus was explaining this parable, his followers could all have fitted in the little kitchen back there behind tea and coffee. All of them could have fitted in the kitchen. It was a tiny mustard seed. Within weeks of his death, the book of Acts tells us there were thousands of Christians. Now, we've come to Ashley Down. We long to see new people come along to church and become Christians. And it's whenever new faces turn up, it's just the most incredible thing. But can you imagine within weeks having thousands turn up? We wouldn't know what to do. You know, we plan for growth and it's awesome, but 3,000 is incredible. And within years, the church was exploding all over the Middle East and the Mediterranean. There's a Christian writer called David Field. He's written this. I guess he took a look at some of the statistics about the growth of the church. And it's quite astounding. He says the statistics are out there. It took 1,400 years for 1% of the world's population to become Christians. And then another 360 years for that to double to 2%. Another 170 years saw that grow from 2 to 4%. And then between 1960 and 1990, the proportion of the world's population made up of Bible-believing Christians rose from 4% to 8%. By 2007, a third of the world's population were confessing that Jesus is Lord, and 11% of the world's population comprised evangelical Christians. The evangelical church is growing twice as fast as Islam, and three times faster than the world's population. South America is turning Protestant faster than Europe did in the 16th century. South Koreans, they reckon they can evangelize the whole of North Korea within 5 years of North Korea opening up. And then there's the Chinese church, consists of tens of millions of Christians who have learned to pray, who have confidence in the scripture, who know about spiritual warfare, have been schooled in suffering, and are qualified to rule. When I read that, I thought, I wish I'd known these statistics earlier. We have to take on board this kind of stuff. It shows God's kingdom is growing, it is expanding, it is getting everywhere to all nations. But I think it's helpful to remember that the growth of God's kingdom is not uniform. So, although the UK is not seeing a mass revival at the moment, other parts of the world, the growth is just staggering. Africa, South America, China, You know, 150 years ago, we're not aware that there were any Chinese Christians. And now there are as many Chinese Christians as there are inhabitants in the UK. In 150 years. And yet, still, our experience, my experience, and I assume everyone else's, is that God's kingdom still does feel, it feels small. Because every day I go into the office, I'm the only Christian I know amongst my contemporaries. Maybe you might feel it in sports practice when, I don't know, banter starts up and you're tempted to join into it, but you know you can't as a Christian, you feel it. Or when you're waiting to sort of pick up kids from school and you're thinking, where are the Christians? Why am I the only one? But the parable of the yeast seems to suggest that even where there is objective statistical growth, the kingdom might feel dispersed and weak. Have a look down at the parable of the yeast. You see, as the yeast reacts, it causes the dough to expand enormously. But the yeast is still dispersed throughout the dough. It doesn't stick together in clumps. And in fact, one of the reasons why the dough expands so massively is because the yeast is dispersed throughout it. One of the reasons why God's kingdom may be spreading so quickly is that the general pattern is not that Christians go round in little clumps and only interacting with each other. We don't live in monasteries, and our experience tends to be that we're surrounded by people who don't believe, school parents, work colleagues, friends, teammates. And I think this very fact, which can lead us to feel vulnerable and assume that God's kingdom is weak, it's actually one of the very reasons why God's kingdom is just expanding everywhere. Because the opportunities for evangelism are enormous when we're surrounded by those who are not believers. There is strength even in seeming vulnerability. I bet your average Christian in China feels very, very vulnerable. But we can take a helicopter view and look down, and we know that the church there is incredibly healthy. So feelings can be misleading, can't they? Feelings can be misleading, and we should be careful before we're led too much by our feelings about whether God's kingdom is strong or not. And actually, we would do well to stop and think the gospel has travelled 2,000 years across Europe and we're here meeting together on Sunday morning. Were it not for the gospel, almost all of us here would just be faces passing in the street. And that came from a bunch of guys who could meet in that little kitchen. So Jesus promised that his kingdom would grow, and it has, objectively, even if sometimes we feel vulnerable. But how can we be sure that it's going to continue growing? See, Apple Computers grew to this enormous company from a mustard seed because Steve Jobs had an ability to think at a high level. He said he didn't believe in market testing because people don't know what they need or want. But he could see, and he had attention to the tiniest detail. But he's now dead, and no one knows where Apple Computers will be in 50 years' time. Is that similar for the kingdom? The reason we should be confident why God's kingdom will continue to grow is the very reason why it has grown for the past 200 years or 2,000 years. Jesus Christ is alive and rules. He describes himself as the beginning and the end. Nothing comes before him or will outlast him. All attempts by the world to suppress his kingdom, they will come ultimately to nothing. Their plans, the Bible says, they're like early dew that disappears or smoke escaping from a window. Christ will have the final word. He will establish his kingdom. The Psalms say that his throne will last forever. that he laughs at the plans of those who plot to overthrow him. Despite the apparent power of atheists and agnostics in the public realm, despite attempts to squeeze Christianity out of school life, or private life, or public life, or work life, all these plans which seem so powerful, to Christ they are flimsy, and he laughs at them. It's as if it's a six-year-old slapping at the knees of a heavyweight boxer. In so many different ways today, man has set himself up as Lord and King, but Revelation calls Jesus the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings. And all the kings and all the lords will have to one day answer to the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. So he is entirely sovereign. Proverbs tells us that he works out everything to his own end, even the wicked for the day of disaster. So nothing which is happening now, which might make us feel discouraged, which might cause us to stumble, none of that happens without Jesus directing it. When God's kingdom appears to be faltering, he is in control. When it seems weak, he is the one who sustains it. All efforts by man to suppress and destroy his kingdom, he's even using those for his ultimate end of establishing his kingdom. There is nothing too small that happens without him ordaining it, even sparrows falling from the air. There's nothing too large that he can't contain. He is the one, Proverbs say, in the book of Job, he gives orders to the morning and puts dawn in its place. Hebrews says he is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. The promises he made about his kingdom to the disciples 2,000 years ago, those promises are true for us in the workplace. They're true for us in the front room. They're true for us in the pub. And they're true on the football field. Nothing has stopped, or can stop, or will stop Jesus Christ from establishing his kingdom. The kingdom is not weak, it is huge. And as the sun kind of breaks through the clouds, God's kingdom is breaking out everywhere. So, knowing this, knowing that the kingdom extends over the whole world, knowing that the King is mighty, that he is the King of Kings, what does that mean? What is that going to mean for us? The three things I want to just mention. First one, that we should break out, not bunker down. We should break out, not bunker down. If we truly get the scale of God's kingdom, we can have great confidence to boldly tell others about an amazing king who we've met and an amazing kingdom we're part of. Typically, when groups feel marginalised or like they're in a minority, their priority becomes kind of preservation rather than expansion. And they will typically spend the majority of their time kind of being defensive and bunkering down and trying to weather the storm, just trying to survive and hang on in there. And there will be churches across Bristol, just like that, who are really managing their own decline. But we should not be tricked into thinking we're a self-preservation society. If we see God's kingdom as it truly is, a kingdom which is spread across the world, which is changing lives, which will continue to grow, then we'll realise we're not here to preserve the status quo. We're not here to minimise losses. We're here to break out into the world and not to bunker down. Shouldn't knowing that fill us with confidence? There's nothing quite like being on the winning side for being reminded it's okay to be bold. It's okay to support your side because they're winners. Let's go. Going back to Andy Murray, you could see towards the end of that match as the balance had tipped in favour of Roger Federer, you could see his shoulders dropped and his head dropped because he lost confidence. He'd lost confidence in his ability to win. But our confidence shouldn't drop. Our heads shouldn't drop because we know Christ's kingdom will be established. We know he's going to be victorious. So on a Saturday evening, when you're trying to build up the courage to speak to your friend, you think, oh, should I do it? Will you remember that you're talking to your friend about the most amazing kingdom which changes lives and transforms the world and is everywhere? Will you remember that? Will you remember that although you might feel alone and feel vulnerable, there are millions and millions and millions of Christians around the world who, if they knew what you were doing, would be praying and urging you to speak of an awesome king? You know, we had a tidal wave of support behind us. We're not alone, so we don't bunker down, we break out. Ours is the most wonderful news of the most incredible kingdom and the most awesome king. Secondly, we can respond to opposition with grace and love. Knowing that God's kingdom is big and everywhere can stop us responding to opposition in a harsh way. I think we have a tendency, again, when we feel threatened, to react bold, to react badly to criticism or threats. Maybe it comes from feeling a bit insecure or vulnerable or lacking confidence. But if we see God's kingdom as small and in need of defending, that there's a risk we'll defend it in a manner which is inappropriate or harsh. But if we see it as it really is a kingdom which is huge and getting everywhere, then we won't do that because we're confident it will continue to grow. There's nothing which can defeat it. So it's not as if it's up to us to build or defend God's kingdom. It's not. It's not our job to do that. Christ is the one who will build it. And, you know, there's a terrible example of this. There's a group of Christians in America from a particular church who have been known to picket outside the funerals of American servicemen who were killed, homosexual American servicemen who were killed out on active service. And they picket outside those funerals because they feel that their death is in some way a judgment of God on a nation which tolerates homosexuality. And it's incredibly harsh way to react, because they don't have confidence that the Lord will build his kingdom and all the efforts by the American government to do what they're doing will some way weaken God's kingdom, or they won't. What about when we hear, you know, deliberately harsh, provocative comments from atheists like Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris? How do we respond to those? Do we respond with an equally virulent attack on the inadequacies of atheism? No, we don't. Because we're confident that their books and arguments will not bring down God's kingdom. You know, so we don't respond in kind. Equally, as the government attempts increasingly to introduce legislation which makes it hard for us to be Christians in the workplace or in the public life, or challenges or changes the kind of very meaning of marriage, we want to stand up to those challenges. Of course we will, and we're called to. But if and when our challenges fail and those policies go ahead, we don't get too depressed. It's not the end of the world, because even if they go ahead, that's not going to change the fact that Jesus Christ will establish his kingdom. We've been freed from the responsibility of thinking it's up to us to build the church and expand the kingdom. It is not. It is his work. It's his church. He builds it. And then finally, we should be encouraged to invest all we have in God's kingdom. Invest all we have in God's kingdom. We're going to look at this in more detail next week when we look at the parable of the pearl and the hidden treasure. So I won't say much in this. Just safe to say that if we think God's kingdom is a bit weak or maybe not worth it, of course we're not going to invest in it with our time or money. I mean, I wouldn't. If you knew something was a slightly weak investment with marginal returns at best, you wouldn't do it. You know, especially when this world offers quite good returns. Jobs which give security, status, friends which give belonging. And that's not to say that we don't invest in church stuff. I'm just saying that I think much of the time we think it's quite important to be balanced in how we invest our time and money and efforts. And we think it would be dangerous to invest too much in the church. It'd be dangerous to put all our eggs in one nest. But if we've understood that God's kingdom is enormous and huge, if we see how valuable it is, we won't want to live a balanced lifestyle. Living a balanced lifestyle would be nuts if you see God's kingdom as it really is. And the world will think we're stupid, the world will think we're unbalanced, which we will be, because they don't know how valuable God's kingdom is. But we know. We know where his kingdom's going. We know what it's worth. We've seen his kingdom as it really is. And so we throw our chips in and we go all in for the gospel. I want to finish going back to our unfortunate friend Ron Wayne, the individual who sold his shareholding at Apple because he didn't trust the promises that it would grow, which came true. And this is true. Ron Wayne now lives in a bungalow somewhere in suburban America. He lives off income support and plays slot machines. Let's not be like Ron Wayne. Jesus Christ is telling us to see the kingdom as it really is. It's huge. It's everywhere. It's growing. He's calling us to stick with him. He's calling us to join him. This is a rallying cry. Let's trust him. Let's go all in for the kingdom. So, Ian, question here. If God's kingdom is growing, does that mean it's not everywhere? Is God not in control of some places or some people? Does that make sense to you? To be honest here, I knew that question was coming from my wife, Fran, because I asked her to ask it. When are we talking about God's kingdom growing, as in the mustard seed grows into a tree, or the kind of the dough expands? There's an implication, really, that obviously before the dough expanded into one particular corner, that corner was empty. And I guess the question is, are we saying there are some parts of the world where God isn't king, and where his kingdom doesn't extend? Are there some people in this world who don't have God as their king? And the answer to that must be no. God is king over every square inch of the world, and he is king in the life of every single person, whether they know it or not. So when we speak of the growth of God's kingdom, what we're not saying is it grows where it isn't already. When we speak of growth, we're talking about growth in recognition that God is king. So when China has massively become Christian, when the kingdom has grown in China, God always was king of all of China. But it's just increasingly recognized there. And an illustration I've heard is that when the sun comes through the clouds and breaks out, we don't say the sun has grown. What we're saying is all of a sudden the sun is revealed and we kind of see it. It always was there.
These ones you aren't prepped for. And a helpful question, actually. We're thinking a lot about God building this, Christ building this kingdom. And there's a question here, if it's not up to us to build God's kingdom, that might be what, take away, that it's not up to us. Does that mean we shouldn't try to build it, if Christ is going to do it anyway?
This comes back to a seeming age-old dilemma between God being responsible. Well, if he's responsible, where does our responsibility lie? And I think I'm right in saying the Bible would say we are both responsible. God is the builder, but he will use us as his tools to grow his church. So because we hear that the kingdom is growing big and everywhere, we will want to be part of that, and he will use us to grow. And at the end of the day, it comes down to the fact, you're sitting in the pub on the Saturday night and your friend asks you about Jesus, which would be rare. Maybe you start the conversation. You're not expecting some kind of lightning bolt and for him suddenly to become a Christian, just like that. We know that God uses us and he puts on our heart a desire to tell our friends about Jesus. But that desire wouldn't come from our hearts naturally. We don't have it innate in us to want to tell our friends about Jesus. He puts it on our heart to want to tell our friends about the kingdom. And he does it through his word and prayer. But he can wonderfully do it sovereignly as well, without us. And sometimes it's a good reminder when he does do that.
Okay. And someone's actually, one of your application points was obviously don't bunker down, but go out. Mm-hmm. And somebody's pointed out that actually sometimes investing in the church feels like we are bunkering down. It can feel like that. So I guess maybe a bit of despondence. Any kind of advice?
So are we saying, you're so much taller than I am. Are we saying that when we spend time investing in the church, doing church stuff, we can feel a bit despondent or discouraged?
I guess it's bunkering down.
Yeah. I think it comes back to the fact that it's because we feel like we're in a minority and things feel small, that's the natural tendency, is to feel vulnerable and have this kind of defensive attitude that people aren't going to listen to us. And I was saying to you just during question time, you know, when you read that criticism about Christianity in the press or just generally, you start believing it yourself, don't you? You start thinking, oh yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe God's kingdom isn't that great. But we want to see what the parable says about God's kingdom and where it's going. And it's important to keep our heads up and remember the promises and not always get caught up in the detail of the fact that there could be more people here.
And there's another question somebody asked about what it means to invest. What's the all in invest all? Especially, for example, if you're someone, they use the example, if you're unemployed, you don't have work, so maybe financially you're restrained. And I know you mentioned we're going to be thinking about this next week, but maybe just as we go from here today, just give us a help with that. What's all in invest all?
It's definitely not money, so we're not asking or expecting people to empty their bank accounts for the kingdom, although if they wanted to do that in a responsible way, they could. And so often it'll be time. It'll mean maybe tiring yourself out on the weekend and doing church things when you could have a more relaxing weekend. I think for us at Ashley Down, it's particularly time, actually, in terms of investing in the kingdom, because to set up in the mornings, you have to come early. You may stay late. There may be someone who's new and actually get to the end of the service, you think, I'm tired, I want to go home and just relax. And actually, you invest and you tire yourself out by inviting new people around and spending time with them. And it's not balanced. You know, we tire ourselves out for the gospel. So it'll be time, it may be money. We may want to be sacrificial about how we spend our money, which will stop us doing other things. I'm sure we'll look at it next week.
Yeah. Great, thanks. And as we said, if you want to follow up any of those questions, or more questions as a result of those questions, or just some that weren't answered, do go and speak to Ian afterwards.